And so next he talks about God's sovereignty, right? The sovereign author of all. So God transcends, he's immanent, right? But he's also sovereign, he's in control. So we see he says this logical progression in this understanding of who God is. We move from the matrix of his transcendent holiness and incomprehensibility to a status as creator. So he has to come down to create, right, and sustainer, and then to his condescending to us in terms of his interaction with his creatures, right? So he goes from transcendent God above all, other than all, to creator, and then to interaction with his creatures, right? Right. So we see this kind of what he calls a logical progression of the understanding of who God is.
Mm-hmm. And also this is, he's still existing outside of his creation. He enters into, but is also outside of, or else he fails to be anything other than the creator, then right. He's just another mere creation within the scope of the universe. Mm-hmm. Some theologians think scripture is unclear of what it means for God to be sovereign, and nothing further could be from the truth. The sovereignty of God is an all-encompassing way to speak of his lordship over all that he has created, his rule, his divine majesty that operates, that can exist, that can do whatever he pleases, and that idea is kind of foreign to us Americans, but within the scope of scripture, both the Old Testament and the New Testament, up until recently, we understood that, and we understood the full effect of that. And even too, if we wanted to talk about, you know, self-sovereignty, that's just another way that we can say, okay, well, what freedoms, what rights do I have? All these things, what does that mean to be in fully control? Now just operate that as a single man on the island. You know, you're Robinson Crusoe, and there's a reason that, like, Austrian economics talks about the Crusoe idea to understand, okay, how you have praxeology, the freedom to do things, to operate, and all these things. So the sovereignty of God is this all-encompassing way to speak of the lordship over all that he has created. As David declares, the Lord, Yahweh, has established his throne in the heavens, and his sovereignty rules over all. Psalm 103. God's sovereignty entails three things. It entails his eternal decree, his providence, and his omnipotence. And so he says, let us consider each of these facets of his divine sovereignty, beginning with his eternal decree.
All right, so God's decree. He tells us that scripture speaks of the decreative sovereign will of God, whereby, as the Westminster Confession of Faith declares, quote, God from all eternity did by the most wise and holy counsel of his own will freely and unchangeably ordain whatsoever comes to pass. So God has ordained everything that comes to pass. His decree, he tells us, is eternal first from all eternity. That's what it says there. And that it was established before the foundation of the world. And of course, this is a quote from Ephesians chapter 3. It is unchangeable, meaning that God planned a fixed course for all things. No one and nothing can change what he's determined to take place, right? This is part of his decree. He quotes Isaiah here, for the Lord of hosts has purposed, and who will annul it? His hand is stretched out, and who will turn it back? Well, the answer is no one, right? Habakkuk says, no plan of God can fail. It is set in stone forever. So once God decrees it, it's a done deal,
right? Yeah, we're throwing spears at the sky, we're kicking the stones, we're trying to change it, and two, we're citing the Westminster Confession, and the confession isn't the standard by which we say this is true because this group of people got together. There's citation of scripture, and he does in his footnotes where they belong and at the foot of all these scriptures that build out these confessions that are just gussied up for us in language that we can memorize and have a better understanding without having to flip through all these verses that indicate this decree. So furthermore, God was not compelled to create the world, right? There's nothing that says, I must create the world because there's a guy with a gun in my back, and I must do this. No, he is not compelled at all, or to order it in any particular manner, except as proceeding from his most wise and holy counsel. God will not author a story that reflects anything less than his holy and perfect nature prescribes. He consulted no one. And so, you know, we talk about, like, can God make a rock so heavy that he himself cannot lift it? Can he make a square circle? No, because those are outside of it's outside of his nature, and there's nothing greater than his nature. So he wouldn't do anything that is inconsistent with his nature. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a non thing to say so heavy he himself couldn't lift it.
Right,
it's outside.
Meaningless.
Yeah, it is actually meaningless.
Yeah.
He orders all things freely and self-determinedly, doing all that he pleases. So if he wants to make 16 people rather than 2, he could have done that. If he wanted to put them in Antarctica, probably warmer back then, he could do so. You know, there's nothing, as we talked about with grace, with the salvation, there's nothing that he says, well, great, now I have to do this. There are qualities of his character that he won't go against. You know, he won't make a creature think that the car is in the garage and both in the garage at the same time and have it be true. Now the creature could think that because of their nature. Yeah. but that wouldn't be the case because it would go against his nature. So again, from his transcendent and his, he can't transcend his own transcendence as some other people want to think, but these first primary orders, secondary orders fall from this. And so these are kind of the outcomes of his nature, not events within the life of God, but from his nature.
All right.